And your job as a photographer is to capture that expression or capture that activity that allows the viewer to kind of finish the story. You know what I mean? So you sort of set up the details and you hope that how the viewer sees it is the story you're wanting to tell, but it's just slightly.
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today we are going off into some of the coolest stuff I can imagine. We're talking with Jim Hayman, who has a career in television and film that is absolutely unparalleled. And before film, during film, and after film, this man has worked with extraordinary still photography. His work has been nominated for Emmy Awards many, many times. He's done work on shows like Desperate Housewives, The Sopranos. He, won an award, the Hong Kong Award for Best Cinematography in An Autumn's Tale, Tokyo Pop, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Northern Exposure, there's one that's close to my heart, Dangerous Minds, The Sopranos, it just goes on and on, ER, Law and Order, Desperate Housewives, House, it goes on. Beginning as a journalist into documentary, into some of the most profound work you can imagine outside of the commercial work, Jim and his wife have also established themselves as real, real philanthropists of trying to give back to communities. Good photography, doing good work is the way I like to explain it. Jim, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for such a beautiful introduction. I'd like to meet this Jim Hayman. He sounds quite amazing.
I think he is amazing. I mean, you look at this list of credits, man. This is just fantastic A-list stuff. And you have a really interesting story of how you got into this work. You claim that you began learning composition watching movies with your mother. Tell me what all that was about.
Well, I grew up in New Jersey, So I grew up in the 50s, so it was the advent of television, and my mother was an insomniac, and living outside New York City, you could watch movies all night long. They had a movie that started around 6 p.m. called The Early Show, and then at 10 o'clock was The Late Show, and then followed by The Late Late Show, followed by The Late 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 Show. Yep. Just went on and on, and my mother loved old black and white movies, mostly of the 30s and 40s. And so she wanted company. So I would stay up with her and I sort of became educated in the movies of John Ford and Howard Hawks and the noir movies, the Dashiell Hammett movies, the mysteries, and those movies, because they were in black and white, had a very graphic sensibility, and particularly the film noir movies where they would use shadows and light to not only give you the information of the location, but also to give you sort of an emotional information about what was going on in the scene. And I think I was drawn to it, and I took that into my, for lack of a better word, artistic DNA. So when I started actually taking photos when I was around 16, that sort of guided how I saw things.
Okay. Well, I mean, at 16, as the story goes, you had an uncle that gave you a camera. Was this accidental, or did he know that you were into visual arts at the time? Did you know that you were into visual arts?
He was a physician.
Okay.
And my whole family actually were made up of physicians, except for me. So when I directed the show ER, I called my mother and said, "You better watch. This is the closest I'm ever getting to being a doctor." He had a lot of hobbies, and at one time it was photography. And he showed me, some of the stuff he was doing, and I professed an interest in it. So he lent me a camera. Mm-hmm. And then another friend of our family sort of went through the same thing and had built a dark room, and then sort of decided that wasn't his hobby. So he had all this dark room equipment, And he gave that to me. And so I set up a darkroom in our one of our bathrooms, putting, you know, a 4x8 piece of plywood over the bathtub and putting trays there. And and I just fell in love with the process, not only the process of shooting, but the process of creating a print. It was very exciting to me. It was like magic. It was alchemy.
But you know, somebody needs to do a gallery exhibition of home darkrooms from the 50s and 60s. Because you know, a lot of people have got that story of these makeshift setups. And I bet you they were, you know, absolutely beautiful in an odd sort of way.
Yeah. That would be an interesting visual journey. It would.
So what attracted you to journalism, though? I mean, you're living outside of New York. You could have gone into fashion. You could have gone into sports. I mean, if you knew you were into photography, what attracted you to the journalistic side?
You know, I came from a liberal, sort of politically semi-active family. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, I guess my draw to photojournalism and journalism in general was that it was it had political overtones. It had overtones of helping society. Mm-hmm. And mostly what I had been shooting up until that point was street photography. So it sort of I felt it would blend right into it. My concept of photojournalism at the time were people like Danny Lyons, you know, people who went to different groups. Like Danny Lyons did a long expose on motorcycle clubs or kids on the boardwalk in Coney Island. And so to me, that was of interest, to be able to ingratiate myself in a subculture and document it visually. So that was more of a draw than fashion. So.
Okay. And so, you know, you go, you study journalism, and you get, I mean, this story is on several of the websites that you're featured on. You get a first assignment that is, you know, really special. You get to go photograph Nixon and Brezhnev and in the Rose Garden at the White House. And it doesn't work out the way you thought it would.
No, it does not. It was... I guess probably after my freshman year in college, and because partially the photojournalism department was small and partially because the professor's name was Moore, liked my work, they gave me a job in I was at American University in Washington, D.C., and they gave me a job at a news service. And the first assignment was to go to the White House Rose Garden and photograph President Nixon and Prime Minister Brezhnev in the meeting, you know, in a meeting of the Soviets and the Americans. And it was July in Washington, D.C. So it was probably about 110 degrees and 100% or 90% humidity.
Yeah.
And you had to wear a jacket and tie. And the only – I was a hippie at the time, and the only jacket I had was a corduroy sport coat. So I put a corduroy sport coat on, a shirt and tie, and I went there. And it was like a shark frenzy. You know, there was just a huge gaggle of photographers. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the photographers from the larger news services had better positions, and everyone else was sort of just trying to, like a scrum, you know, push their way into getting a good angle. And I got the photograph and it ran and, you know, it all worked. And it was exciting, of course, to be, you know, photographing this opportunity. But I did not care for the frenzy of it. And it felt like my first introduction was introduction to paparazzi. Mm-hmm. That was what was necessary, you know, to get – it was all elbows and camera lenses. And it just wasn't my thing. You know, like I said, I was a hippie. I saw myself as an artist, even doing long photojournalistic exposés. So I backed off from the journalism thing.
And you went to film.
Right. I still stayed in the department for my second year. But in my second year, I took a film class. And it was a film history class. But it just opened a set of doors to storytelling that fascinated me. And I think when I think back on it, I think I was always a storyteller. You know, my street photography even then was trying to create a narrative of who I was photographing. And so these two, you know, arenas kind of paralleled. And then after my sophomore year, when I really thought I wanted to really actually study film, I applied to University of California at Santa Barbara because it was 73, I guess. It was a college on the beach in California. And I was like, what? Yeah, let's do that. And they had a just forming film studies department. You know, at that point there was UCLA, but I wasn't ready to get into commercial filmmaking. And the idea of studying film and maybe being able to create a film production section of this film studies course was exciting to me. So that's what I did.
Oh, very cool. Now, you've hit upon something that's dear to my own heart, and this is the notion of storytelling. And I can see the parallels between still photography and film work or video work in a lot of the technical things, in composition, in lighting, in framing, you know, this kind of stuff. But it strikes me that the storytelling aspect, when, you know, on one side you have, you know, a few hours, you know, half an hour to a few hours, you have multiple camera angles, you have the ability to take and retake and retake. Whereas on the other side, you've got 1/60th of a second, you know, or whatever. Those connections are not quite as obvious or quite as easy. So in your mind, what are the storytelling problems and similarities between still and motion?
Well, like you said, when you're working in film, you not only have images, but you have the juxtaposition of images. Mm-hmm. So that goes a very long way in helping you tell your story. In film studies, they looked at a Russian filmmaker named Pudovkin, who is sort of known, I think it's Pudovkin, who is sort of known as the creator of editing.
Okay.
And what he did was he photographed a woman and he photographed a bowl of soup and he cut them together and he asked people what they saw. And so they said, oh, well, this woman is hungry, because he had shown them something to eat, you know? So you have that going for you in motion pictures. You have dialogue. You know, there are a lot of aspects to telling the story. And as you said, you certainly have time. I think what's interesting in still photography, one, is that I'm a humanist. So that to me, a person's face alone can tell a story. A person doing a task can tell a story. And your job as a photographer is to capture that expression or capture that activity that allows the viewer to kind of finish the story. You know what I mean? So you sort of set up the details and you hope that how the viewer sees it is the story you're wanting to tell, but it's just slightly more abstract than, you know, watching a television show or a movie.
Mm-hmm. Can a single image be narrative?
Absolutely. I feel absolutely.
Okay.
There's a famous image of soldiers putting up a flag on Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
Everybody's seen it, right?
Yeah.
Well, that tells a story. I mean, there's a story there and you can't miss it, really, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think back to Danny Lyons, he has a photograph in Coney Island of a kind of 50s greaser type combing his hair. No, the girl has teased hair and she's combing it in the window, in the mirror of a cigarette machine, and the guy's rolling his cigarettes up in his t-shirt sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that tells a story not only of who they are individually, but who they are as a couple. Yeah, I think if you look at some of my work, particularly what I call my social conscience work, for instance, I have a photograph of a homeless person under a bridge in New Orleans.
Yes.
And I spoke to him And I asked him if I could take a photograph. He immediately saluted. So I have a photograph of this man in front of the tent he's living in saluting. To me, that tells the story that he's a vet. And that's what that's the story he wanted to tell me when I took the photo. So,
as a documentarian and as a street photographer, what role do you think the viewer has? Because I mean, you say on your website in your artist statement, you say photography is an interactive experience, an exchange between listener and storyteller, which is, you know, a beautiful line. I love the fact that you've got listener in there as the description for the people on the outside. But I don't know that guy's story.
Right. You don't. But what I'm hoping is that the image that I've given you will lead you to create that story. So we sort of create it together, you know? I think it works also in the photographing of that image, because I used to always work in a kind of surreptitious fashion, which is pretty typical for street photography. So you try to get a photograph where people don't know you're photographing. So you capture them in a private moment. And then when I moved to New Orleans, I was told when I moved down there, I moved there to run a TV show. So I lived there for almost 7 years.
Right.
Someone said to me, listen, in New Orleans, if you ask someone how they are, you better have 20 minutes because they're going to tell you. And I kind of took that to heart. And so that eventually, after a couple of years, I think I became that guy who would take 20 minutes. But my process shifted then. So I would take a photograph surreptitiously. I would try to capture a private moment, but then I would engage with the subject. And I'd talk to them a little bit. Then I'd ask if I could take a picture. And then normally that picture I took was the subject presenting to me who they want to be. Yeah. And I found that's interesting because that's a two-way street then, which is sort of what I started calling my photography, two-way street photography. And then as the conversation continued, the subject would sort of let their guard down or just sort of forget that I was photographing. And then something really interesting would come up because they were comfortable. They were more at ease. And what came out of that was a narrative that the two of us had come up with, I feel, as opposed to me just seeing it and this subject not being aware of it.
Was this still in the film days or had you switched over to digital at this time?
No, I was digital at that time. But you know, it's interesting. When I stopped working in television in 2020, because of COVID, I shut down the show I was doing in New Orleans, a show called NCIS New Orleans. And
few people have heard of that one. Okay.
So when I shut that down, I was like, all right, I'm done. And then I wasn't done. Then I was done. But I decided to go back sort of full time to photography. And I, through a series of friends, found a public relations firm called PR for Artists. And they kind of took me on and are representing me. And they, when I was talking to them about, you know, my past and who I was, et cetera, I explained I've been shooting photos for 50 years and that I traveled to Guatemala and Central America and Mexico and Japan and China and all over the world photographing. They were like, whoa, well, let's look at that stuff. So I went back to my film negatives at that point and started digitizing them and printing them. And when I looked at it, I saw there really was a continuum of approach that the work that I did, particularly in Central America while I was working for the UN, there's very much an interaction between photographer and subject. So I think I had it when I was younger, and then it went kind of dormant, and then it came back when I was in New Orleans.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
I love this notion of cooperation or transaction between the subject and the photographer, because, you know, as you said, you know, you catch an unguarded moment if you're using a long lens or they don't know you're there. But, you know, that unguarded moment may be untrue to who they are. I love this notion of gaining trust, gaining, you know, showing them that you believe that they have some integrity. And then, yeah, they show you a moment that is decided, but still honest, right? Or do you get a lot of performers that are, you know, showing off?
Well, I think as I said before, that the first photo or first couple of photos is a performance of sorts. Mm-hmm. It's them trying to present themselves as they feel, you know,
right,
as they see themselves. But then if the dialogue continues, then they just become themselves. You know, they're not performing. That's what I'm hoping for.
When you're doing street work, do you show them the back of your camera?
They don't usually ask it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if one did, I would, but it's not something that I make part of my process, you know?
You mentioned South America and Mexico a moment ago. And again, reading your bio, reading this stuff, that was really a transformative time. So tell me about the earthquake. Tell me about being down there and how that, you know, sort of set a compass heading for you.
Well, I had graduated college and I sort of had a game plan at that point to at some point go to graduate school in film. Mm-hmm. So I needed a portfolio. So a friend of mine and I decided to go overland through Mexico, Central America. We were hoping actually to get to South America. And we ended up spending a lot of time in Mexico. And then as we were heading into Guatemala, there was a pretty severe, 7.2 earthquake in Guatemala. This was 1976. So we caught a lift with some people from Canada in a van, and we were just trying to move through Guatemala because it was, you know, it was a disaster area. And we spent a night in Guatemala City, and some people from the university, from the American University down there, different from this American University I went to in DC, but it was called the American University, came by and asked if anyone wanted to volunteer and work for the United Nations, who were down there doing earthquake relief. And both my friend and I said, absolutely. So we ended up, he didn't stay quite so long, but I ended up working and living in Guatemala for maybe four months. And working for the UN took me to areas of Guatemala I would have never gone to, because it took me out to the hinterlands, up into the mountains and into the jungle, and to places where it really showed me the political nature of the world. It's mm-hmm. very different from the United States, mm-hmm. you know, and it was quite an eye-opener for me. I remember one of the villages we went to, you know, the basic question was, well, what do you need because of the earthquake? And the heads of this village kind of laughed at us and said, everything we needed before the earthquake. You know, we're a poor town. We don't have anything. Mm-hmm. So, and I also watched the military take the majority of the things that were sent down and just hoard them. And they never got to these villages. So it kind of politicized me as well.
No, so you're volunteering for the UN, but you've got your camera with you. And were you being intentional about that? I'm looking at the galleries right now. I'm looking at the stuff on your websites. And, you know, it is remarkable, remarkable work. Did you conceive of yourself as a photographer at the time? Or was that simply the stuff you were squeezing in between other moments?
No, first and foremost, I was a photographer.
Okay.
And I went down there to photograph. And by being a photographer, I had the opportunity to help these people. And I felt like I was helping these people by, you know, getting all the information that the UN wanted, by the physical work of, you know, bringing supplies to villages. But I was also, in my mind, helping people by photographing them and trying to get those photographs out to the world so people could see how people existed.
Tell me the story of the sort of marquee, the first image on the Americas series.
Yeah. So I was high in the mountains in northwest Guatemala, and we were in a village and we had done our work for the day, and I was just sort of walking around the village, and there was this group of women. So it's all women except for one, you know, toddler boy that's being held by a young woman, right, and a dog. And I photographed them. And it was interesting because in this group, the majority of subjects in this group weren't aware of me. I should go back and explain how I photographed, because I am enamored with Cartier-Bresson.
Okay. And
so I shoot with a Leica. At that point, I shot with a Leica M2 and a 35 millimeter lens, because that's what he shot with. And I was very formal about it. And I always printed full frame. But what that means is that you have to get close to your subject, which I think is at the heart of street photography. You know, you had said earlier that, yeah, you can capture a moment with a long lens. I don't consider that, in a purest sense, street photography. I feel that a less obvious camera and a wide lens, you get in there and you can photograph. People don't even know you're doing it, you know? Whether you have the camera to your eye or you're holding the camera below your face, but you understand you have a wide lens, so you're going to get this frame.
It's, you know, that approach, which is not one that I use either. My standard lens is a 28 millimeter. There is not only a lack of interaction, but there's kind of lack of responsibility as well, which some people would see as an asset. You know, I'm not influencing the scene. You know, the counter argument is that when you're interacting with the subjects, you're also changing them. That's not one you buy?
No, I guess if you're interacting with the subject, then you're changing that dynamic. But if it's speaking about that specific photograph, it doesn't look like I've changed the dynamic to misrepresent the world or those
right
people, you know?
Yep. Well, it is a remarkable photograph, and all of your series here on the website that I've seen is just stunning work. You have a great story. You go back to New Orleans for a second, that, you know, about when a parade interrupted your TV production.
I moved to New Orleans in 2014, and as a executive producer director on NCIS New Orleans. And the first episode that I was directing, I had a huge action sequence in the French Quarter, in right off what's called Decatur Street, which is sort of a main thoroughfare in the French Quarter. So we're shooting all day, and as in television, you never have enough time. And now it's the end of the day, and I'm starting to run out of light, and I still have a lot to shoot. And so I'm anxious, and I'm telling people, come on, we got to go, go, go. And in the middle of this, a second line parade with a brass band comes down Decatur Street, and the sound guy is yelling, "We can't shoot because of the sound, because of the band." I was like, "I don't care about the sound. We'll dub it. Let's keep shooting." And then I notice, one by one, every one of my crew members takes out a white handkerchief, which is what you use in a second line parade, and literally dances from my set across to Decatur Street and into the parade. And I sort of have this moment of like, okay, let's do it. So then I find the handkerchief and I go, and we all dance in this parade, and the parade continues down the street, and we go back and we finish our work for the day and we get it done. And, you know, it was such a sort of life epiphany for me that it's just a television show. It's just the work you're doing. And if a parade comes by, you should partake of it. You should partake of every moment in your life.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was, yeah, like I said, it was a game changer for me. It really was. I think it's one of the things that so embraced me about New Orleans. I still live down there part-time. I have a house down there. I just, mm-hmm. I find it an amazing city. And from a photographic point of view, so much imagery to be able to photograph, from the have-nots to the haves, from the nature of the bayou to the music of Frenchman Street. I just think culturally it's a gumbo, as we say.
You know, you have worked as producer, as director, as cinematographer. Are those skills, in terms of how they feed your still photography, are they all related, or is it just the cinematography that is sort of a corollary?
I think they all have contributed to making me the photographer I am now. And I think the photographer I was initially contributed to each of those positions. I think that if you sort of do a timeline, I started as a photographer. Mm-hmm. Then in film school, I started making Super 8 movies. And then I went to grad school and sort of centered on, I went to NYU grad school for film and centered on cinematography. Then I was a cinematographer for a long time. And then that brought up the opportunity of directing. So by the time I started directing, I knew how to tell a story visually, you know?
Okay.
So being a cinematographer helped me as a director. And the area that I needed to learn about more was how to talk to actors, how to get a performance, how to, you know, tell a story, not only visually, but orally. But having worked as a cinematographer for a long time, I was lucky enough to have directors I had observed how they work.
Right.
And so then I was a director. So then I learned that process and integrated the processes I had from cinematography with processes I learned as a director. And then I got an opportunity, I started directing pilots for shows, and I got an opportunity to produce a show, which for me is much more enjoyable than going from show to show being a director for hire, because you really get to create the world, to create the storytelling mm-hmm. when you're producing a show. But in order to do that, the fact that I had been a camera assistant, I had been a camera operator, I had been a cinematographer, I had been a director, it allowed me to take all that I had learned about how a television show is made and use that as a producer to get a television show made.
And when you're walking around with a still camera in your hand, these voices are all in your head?
I don't think they're in your head. I think they are in your DNA.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I think yeah. that all of those jobs have coalesced into my desire to work as a narrative photographer. I also think it's similar to what I told my children when they went to undergrad, when they went to college, which is just study as much as you can in a variety of arenas, because mm-hmm. all of that is going to make you the artist that you want to be, as opposed to going to just film school, you know? So when I was an undergraduate, I took Russian history, I took art history, I took English. I think I didn't take one math course, but, but as a producer, it's pretty elementary when you think about it, you know, that really it's, okay, how much money do we have? Mm-hmm. Okay, what's it going to cost? Okay, what do we need to cut out to get to that number? It's pretty simple.
but you took the persuasive courses to get more money out of the accountants.
I did.
Jim, I want to read something to you from your website, because you are not just someone who takes an image, you know, a socially important image, and puts it on the wire and hopes that it does some good. You have taken the next step in a big way that a lot of photographers don't, of actually stepping up and doing good yourself. And I love this statement here. I'm going to quote you. You say, throughout my career, career, I've used photography to engage with people, share their stories, reveal their truths. I do not want to shy away from the inequities that are very real and often go unseen in our daily lives, but I also do not want to merely observe. This is why philanthropy and volunteerism must be another part of that photographic engagement. I encourage everyone to not merely observe, but to expand our awareness and our support whenever and wherever possible. Tell me about this step to volunteerism, to activism, to being a participant in making the changes that you hope the photographs are going to provoke.
Well, as I said, I came from a politically liberal family, and so I was sort of taught that if you have something, then you need to keep an eye on the people that do not. And mm-hmm. and do what you can. But it really came to fruition in 2020 when COVID shut the world down. My wife, who's an actress, mm-hmm. Annie Potts, started making masks for people. And so that was the initial way that she felt like she had to give back. Just the simple thing of actually making masks. Mm-hmm. And then that led to Annie and myself and another couple starting a charity called All Are One, in which we were giving to people in need, people that couldn't get those checks from the government because maybe they were unhoused or maybe they were didn't have citizenship, they didn't have tax information, so they weren't getting these help checks. We were giving out sums of money equal to those checks to people in need. And then I was photographing that process, and that mm-hmm. and it sort of became the lizard swallowing its tail. The photographs then got people interested in giving money, and then we gave more money. And so that I realized that I felt really good that I was actually doing something that was actually doing some good. That led to another charity here in Los. The first one was in the Bay Area and South Carolina. And then we opened one here in Los Angeles called Finding Francis, which did that on a much larger scale. Mm-hmm. We connected with the school system in Pacoima, which is an area of Los Angeles that's a lower income area and has an incredibly high percentage of students that are unhoused. And we gave out gifts there as well, you know, monies there as well. And then Annie started another charity called the Heart Channels, which is sort of an emergency fund. If someone is in need for a specific thing, like we just help people rent an apartment because they were unhoused and they have jobs, but they didn't have enough money, or if someone needs food immediately or medical care. And subsequently, I was connected to a gallery in Florence, Italy, and I suggested us doing a show of my social conscience photography, and any money from the sale of prints or NFTs would go to this charity. Mm-hmm. And so we had a very successful show, and we raised money that went into the Heart Channels. And again, it's very fulfilling. At this point in my life, I feel like I'm blessed and lucky to be able to do this. And so that's what I'm doing.
My hat's off to you, man. I am completely in admiration of it, because photographers, you know, we can hide behind a lens, right? We can hide behind a camera. And those of us that step out from around it and say, I am in this community, I'm going to participate in this community, even if it's temporary community, when you're traveling through, that raises the stakes for us. That engages us with our subject in a completely new way. Jim, what are you working on now in the still world? What are you working on now?
I'm actually leaving in 2 days to go back to Italy because I have a show in a little town, a little medieval coastal town between Naples and Rome. It's through the same gallery, which is Studio ABBA, mm-hmm. ABBA. in Florence, but they every summer they do a large group show in this little town. But what's interesting is not only do I have physical prints in this show, but we're going to be working with artificial intelligence. We're going to be working with DALL-E or Midjourney, ChatGPT, to try to see how, as an artist, I can take the work I've done with my camera and make something else out of it. So I know there's a lot of dialogue about AI and a lot of fear about it. And I think the fear is important. But I also think that as an artist, you can use this format to create art. So that's what I'm looking to do with it. And I don't know. I've never been in a show where I went there and didn't really know what was going to come out of it. And I find that very exciting. You know, so.
That would be thrilling. And, you know, animation did not kill film. CGI did not kill film. And nobody seems to have there are small issues, but nobody has big issues about that these days. I think, you know, personally, there are people who are going to cheat. They're going to do AI and claim it's a lens-based piece of work. But we've had dishonest people in every form of life since the beginning of time. And, you know, you're aware of it. I think there's a really interesting potential that's just beginning to be revealed there. And we're going to have to wait and see how it comes out.
I agree. I think that's exactly right. And I think that every piece of art starts with the kernel of an idea.
Right.
And then you find your process to bring that kernel of an idea to fruition. And if it's solely lens-based, that's great art. If it's digitally adjusted, that's interesting art. It's all interesting. So
I'm suddenly remembering a moment. There was an event here in town and I was out photographing it and I saw another street photographer out photographing it. And about 10 minutes later, I saw she'd climbed up on top of a food truck and was taking pictures. I looked at her, smiled, and I said, "That's cheating." And she goes, "No, that's being resourceful." there's a metaphor in there somewhere for somewhere. About everything.
Yeah.
Jim, this has been a fantastic conversation. Your work is beautiful work. Both on the video and on the still side, the still stuff, so much more we could talk about in terms of your subjects and compositions. It's just aesthetically pleasing. It's socially responsible. I love every bit of it. Thank you for talking with us today.
It's been absolutely my pleasure. And good luck with everything. And I can't wait to hear the podcast. I'm curious how you're going to make me sound good.
that's not going to be an issue at all. Thank you, sir. Talk to you later.
Okay, take care.
Frames, because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.